are the ones who live here.
نحنا يلي عايشين هون.
I am Farah Khatib and we are proud to share with you these stories of life in Lebanon. This episode contains frank conversations about war and its aftermath. We know that some people may find stories on this topic difficult to hear. If it feels like this might be you, take care of yourself first. So far, in the current war to destroy my country, the one that's still ongoing and has been raging since October of 2023, Israeli jets and drones have struck our villages, our healthcare facilities, and our homes about 15,000 times. This is just the latest attempt to destroy Lebanon, though, and many of these recent attacks have been gross violations of the international laws of war. A clear and outright set of war crimes that have been supported and funded by Western countries for decades. We are a small country. And since October of 2023, over 1 million of us were displaced from our villages. This means that one out of every 5 Lebanese families was driven from their homes. And since the so-called ceasefire in November of 2024, Israel has not stopped their regular attacks on Lebanon. Israeli troops agreed to withdraw from our southern lands, and for the most part, they haven't done it. They've just kept attacking. They keep carpet bombing villages like Ansar and the Biqaa Valley. They keep attacking our civilians. In fact, by the recording of this audio, Israel has attacked Lebanon more than 1,400 times since that agreement. A one-sided ceasefire that, in fact, ceased nothing. It's all a cruel joke. At this point, the numbers mean nothing. I can tell you that Israel has directly killed more than 4,000 people in Lebanon. I can tell you that the number of direct deaths from Israeli attacks in Gaza is over 50,000 now. And the indirect ones caused by starvation, by diseases, by infections and torture are close to 200,000. But everyone has seen those numbers. That's how the war is reported. All big numbers that blur together. At this point, seeing 20 or so deaths in a day felt like a blessing. It could have been worse. It was worse. The news is full of big and scary numbers. And altogether, they mean nothing except that the problems of the world are overwhelming. And your brain has to just go numb so you don't get overwhelmed because you've still got shit to do with your own life. You've heard the numbers. And you may think that you know who we are, but we will tell you about us. We're going to tell our stories of life in Lebanon differently. Life here has always been relatively absurd, an average regular level of absurdity that became who we are, part of our familiar identity. But the absurdity has now heightened and had a manic break, and we're now living in the strange aftermath. Life here, currently, recently, and has always been controlled by governments of other countries. Now, another state that has tried to occupy us before is acting in supposed self-defense. They would send a text or even post a tweet of an evacuation order, just assuming, I guess, that you're watching your Twitter feed at that particular moment. They're warning you that your home is about to be destroyed. And they would send it to you minutes after they've already sent the missiles that will very shortly pulverize it and kill your child, your mother, your neighbor. That taunting and diabolically ironic text message was hailed as a sign of restraint in the international press. So we're not going to make it seem like life here makes any sort of coherent rational sense. We're going to tell you our stories in snippets and vignettes. We don't want your sadness or your impotent guilt. We want your outrage and your understanding, We want you to be a witness and to share these stories with other people. And we want you to think about how what's happening here can happen anywhere in the world if we sit back and let it.
Yani, Tarfit, something happened with me today. I just remembered while you were talking to me. I was out, yani, I ordered the cab, okay, and I told him, no, please pick me up from my house, and no, بدي جيب غرض وارجع البيت. هيدي من الصبح, okay? My stepmom, she calls me, she's like, Rin, and when ente? I'm like, no, I'm in the cab. She tells me on the phone, with which cab are you going? I was like, I'm going with Hussein. And she's like, oh, Hussein's house was destroyed. Like, don't go with Hussein. Like, call a different cab company. I was like, هلا بشوف شو بعمل. Like, no, I'll see what I'm gonna do, because I really, يعني, I panicked. I didn't know what to do, you know? I hung up the phone, and then I looked at Hussein. I looked at him after I heard what she said, and his face was like, his eyes was red, yani, his face was so tired and sleepless, yani. And I told him, Alhamdulillah, Salame. And he was like, Allah yisalmik, kif arifte?
How did you know?
And I told him, Rula told me, like my stepmom, she told me that your house was destroyed. He's like, it's not destroyed. It's not there. I was like, how did this happen? Were you targeted as part of some kind of party or something? He's like, I'm asking myself the same question. I don't know why me and my friend's house would be targeted, and we are just living there with our families and not associated with anyone.
And it's their individual houses, like they're not
family house. No. Oh, Bella, it's a building and they're apartments. Okay, so it's him on the fourth floor and his neighbor on the third. Both of them gone, but the building is still intact. But it's just their houses. So when I heard that it's just their houses, something internal, yani, it's. I had this dilemma of me wanting to be extremely empathetic. At the same time, I feared for my life because. Yeah. You know, because you're like, what if I'm being targeted in this car? What if I'm being heard? What if I'm being, you see what I mean? But then I tried to forget that for a minute. And I was like, I'm really, really sorry for your house. And then he started crying and he held his phone. Wallahi, I was going, وحيت الله, يعني دمع قلبي من الوجع قد ما he was, ما عنده شي يحكي. عم بقلل, all he's saying is, Alhamdulillah. I'm like, he showed me his house.
It's so horrible.
He was showing me a video during midday. He went there. It's all ruins. He told me nothing stayed from my house except a wooden name of my son, Hassan. That's it. Yani, no furniture, no walls. No floor, nothing. There's nothing. He told me, I just moved in with my family to this house a week ago and they bought it. And he's been struggling so hard for years to buy a house for his family. So just imagine, yani, just imagine the situation. Wallah, yani, I told him, عن جد, إنه, I have no words to say except, إنه, الحمد لله السلامة والله يعوضك, يعني. عن جد غير هيك. ما بعرف, بس when I hear such a story and in the most يعني unexpected time, you know, I think إنه this happened right next to my house. Like this happened 2 minutes away from me. 2 minutes away from my house, and I'm like, it can be anyone. If this person wasn't associated with any party and he was targeted because it was a mistake, that's what he said. He said, and no, there are these files that are coming in of people's names that are mistakes. I was like, and what if our name was a mistake and suddenly this happens, you know what I mean? So it's very disturbing to think about, yani, to think about people's lives being lost because of a mistaking someone's name for someone else, for example. Imagine, and this person has been trying to make an income for years, and now look, and it's all gone in one split second.
That's Lien Jrade, the associate producer of this podcast. I spoke with her in November of last year. That week, I also spoke with Rana Baghdadi, who's a member of our editorial team.
How have you been? Yani.
Had you asked me, I don't know, maybe a few days ago, I was doing better than these 2 days. Yesterday, I basically cried myself to sleep. Like, just thinking about all the loss, there's so much grief that I don't know where to go with it. And where do you go with all this grief?
Rana lives in Dahiyeh, the southern suburb of Beirut that has been one of the most frequently struck places by Israel, with many of these strikes using 2,000-ton bombs on this densely populated residential area.
You hear about a lot of numbers, you hear of a lot of people who have died. People everywhere, the bigger population, do not realize how much this loss hits very close to some of us.
Yeah.
My cousin who's staying with me, so far she has lost like 3 classmates from school, 2 teachers with whom she was very close. I have a best friend who has lost a brother.
Oh my God.
And every day we randomly, said, "Hey, hi, Anna, from the Daya. This old lady moved to Aramon, for shelter. Now she died there. Because of the
random strike.
There's so much. There's so much loss. There's so much grief, and there's so much rage on my part, and I am almost forced to subdue this rage and this grief to go about my daily life as if to go about my day as if nothing is happening. I'm still expected to do my job fully. I'm expected to attend to my students, but no one attends to me. I'm not sure also what my work can offer me, and I'm not looking for sympathy, but it pisses you off to see that there are so many people who genuinely don't give a shit. But I've been getting all these messages of professor, thank you so much, you've been very great. Genuinely, you've been the most considerate, you've been the most sympathetic with our conditions. And in my head, I started to kind of ask myself, what in God's name are other professors doing at this moment with their students? So I went around and was asking my students about their major courses, their other courses, and I met with one student today, and he was telling me about how, and this is in his own words, he said, so a lot of professors were faking their understanding. So at first they said they would do so and so, but now they're back to all of this material. We're having to do a million assessments. No one is really kind of accommodating the current situation. And it just blew my mind because, I've had students who lost their homes. I had students who've lost family members.
The sadness and fear that we've been living in have become so normalized that it becomes the average emotional state. So people don't take it into consideration. People don't have the emotional capacity to feel what they need to feel. So they repress their fear, their sadness, and their trauma. They say, it's fine, we're okay, live your life, do your thing. but we've never been okay. And this makes it very difficult to consider other people's experiences when you're always repressing your own. We're not going to repress it anymore. Lynn, do you want to tell the story again?
Whew! I don't like this story. I don't like it. I can't even process it at this moment. I can't even process it. لأنه I can't fathom the fact that I escaped death multiple times and a lot of people next to me couldn't. I just can't fathom that fact. Yeah. So it was one of those evenings where I got paid and my mom needs money, you know, and so I give her money, like a monthly allowance every month, because she cannot really sustain herself or her son on a monthly basis. And so I go to the nearest OMT, or the OMT that usually opens at this hour, which is next to Hara. And so I went there. And as I was sending, as I was sending the money, خلاص, مش الحال, I went back in the car. The minute I went back in the car, I heard like a loud explosion, but there was so much pressure in the car because I had the windows closed. And so the car was reverberating back and forth. And I swear to God, 2 seconds, I saw everyone just panicking and screaming in the streets, and everyone was running, and suddenly there was an ambulance, and I was like, what the hell is going on? I just looked all around me, and I just saw everyone yelling and screaming and jumping. Someone was going in the taxi, leaving someone, a family was taking its children in the cars, a father was holding his child and like throwing them in the car. You see a lot of chaos that was spreading in seconds, and you can't even capture all of that, and you're just freezing in time. You're like, and what should I do? So you just turn the wheel and you're like, you run back home, but then when I reached home, my dad was telling me, and no, darabul hara, like they struck Hara. And I was like, I know. But I didn't say that I was there. I never actually told anyone that I was there, because that would create a bigger problem, saying that I was close to death, basically.
Her existence was almost obliterated at a random moment on a random day for no real reason at all. She could have become one of those terrible statistics, and her immediate reaction was to spare her family the burden of knowing about it and all the additional worry that would inflict on them. So she pushed it down, until now. We don't talk much about PTSD in Lebanon, because we rarely get to the post in post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD feels like a privilege, because it means that you were able to get past the trauma. Sometimes, though, the cycle of traumas slows, and you can catch your breath. And that's exactly when the tragedy of everything crashes down on you. I asked Rana how she was feeling after the so-called ceasefire.
I think, and because actually, a number of people asked me this question during the war and after. And their question was, how are you feeling? And during the war, it was very strange what I was feeling, because I think mentally I was doing my best during the war, which is very strange. Because during the war, I felt an urge to keep going. And in keeping going, I felt like I was working towards better, what is better. And I was working towards the hope that existed. So in my head, I'm like spending these days with the hope of what is to come. And one direct hope was the war ending. But I feel like the grief registered after the war. And this is when I started to slip into, how do I say it? A melancholy, perhaps. Like, emotionally speaking, I don't think I have recovered from, like, the day of the ceasefire announcement. And I remember throughout a month and a half, or was it 2 months? I can't remember how long the war was. But throughout the entirety of the war, not once did I stay home. I would get up every day, fully dressed, full face of makeup. If not, I go to the gym. And then after that, again, fully dressed, full face of makeup, go about my business, run errands, go to a cafe, work, write. And I was even doing creative work, which I struggle with a lot. But on the day of the ceasefire announcement, which was very late in the evening. So the next morning, and then for the entirety of that day, I was lying in bed and crying. I was suddenly hit with a sense of absolute despair, and I felt like all the grief that I have been, I would say, just brushing on, hit me all at once, like this big slap in the face. And so I couldn't get out of bed, and I was crying the entire day. And I don't think I've recovered yet from that particular day.
So that's how we've been. This isn't the season 2 that we planned on putting out. It was going to have different stories, stories that don't seem as important to us anymore. We were going to release it last summer too. It's been hard to focus on anything, honestly, and sometimes our faith in the power of storytelling has slipped. All you have to do is look over the border to Palestine. There were plenty of storytellers in Gaza and the West Bank. Plenty of people documenting everything that was happening to them. And all those stories, constantly streaming around the world, did not stop the atrocities. But we kept working on these stories when we could, when we had the energy and the optimism. And now we share them with you, to be our witness, as we try to make sense of all of this. We Are the Ones Who Live Here was produced by Ben Murad and me, Farah Khatib. Our associate producer is Lien Jradi. Our editorial team includes Rita Mhanna, Rana Baghdadi, Elias Demadjian, Maya Adra, Nasreen Azizi, Jennifer Nasrallah, and Leticia Harib. Our sound producer is Wilson Vedina. Our music was made by Rafi Vghali, aka Tsatsa. We want to thank our Season 2 hero, Aisha Ghazoul, and our Season 2 sponsors, Stephanie Barr, Jay Schubert, and Michelle Murad, for their exceptional support. We couldn't have done this without you. This podcast was also made possible with the support of the Center for American Studies and Research, CASAR, at the American University of Beirut. We want to hear your stories of life in Lebanon, or just what you think of the show. Reach out to us on Instagram at WeLebanonPod. You can also email us at WeLebanonPod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.